Hello, you're watching Global Investor on Business Day TV. I'm Stephen Gagnon. On the show this week, Momentum Investments' Stephen Schultz takes us through global markets news making headlines. Then in our fund segment, Stephen van Jaarsveld from Methodical Investment Management puts forward the investment case for their global equity fund. All that coming your way shortly. First, though, a quick look at what's been making the headlines. Samsung Electronics has been dealt another blow. Its CEO, Kun Oh-yeon, has resigned from the company, citing an unprecedented crisis. Kwon was seen as the next in line to steer the company after previous chief J.Y. Lee was convicted over bribery charges earlier this year. BMW is in talks with China's Great Wall Motor Company to make electric versions of the Mini Cooper. The talks are described as preliminary and do not call into question BMW's Mini facilities in the UK. Great Wall Motor shares spiked 14% on news of a potential tie-up. And U.S. President Donald Trump has urged Democrats to partner with him after he scrapped billions of dollars in Obamacare subsidies to private health insurers for low-income Americans. The news has received mixed reaction. Take a look at this report.
Such an exciting event.
President Donald Trump once again pledged to dismantle Obamacare as California, New York, and other states join forces to sue to block his move.
It's step by step by step. And that was a very big step yesterday. Another big step was taken the day before yesterday. And one by one, it's going to come down, and we're going to have great health care in our country.
On Thursday, Trump signed an executive order to allow insurers to sell lower-cost, bare-bones insurance plans with limited benefits and consumer protections. He also scrapped subsidies to health insurers that help low-income Americans pay out-of-pocket medical expenses. The National Association of Insurance Commissioners cried foul. It said Trump's move would jack up premiums for consumers by up to 15% in 2018 and slash payments to insurers by more than $1 billion. Consumer unions, Betsy Imholz.
Well, the past 2 days have really been a double blow to consumers on health care. Between yesterday's executive order and today's announcement about withholding of the cost-sharing reduction payments, they really together destabilize the market incredibly, will raise prices, and not to mention all the confusion that it's created and the fear for consumers.
Shares of health insurers and hospital shares fell. Centene and Tenet Healthcare were hard hit.
Stephen Schultz from Momentum Investments joining me in studio now. Stephen, a very good evening. Any concerns that Trump's move to dismantle Obamacare could have a detrimental effect on the healthcare sector in the U.S.?
Yeah, so Donald Trump's got this crazy gift of wherever he goes, he creates mixed reactions. Some cheer him, some hate him. So it's probably a little bit early to say exactly what his move is, whether it's good or bad. And by the same measure, his tax reforms, he's put down a framework which appears to be saving corporates from 35% to 20%.
And rich people.
Rich people, individuals, simplification and reduction. But the real question there is who's going to fund it? So it looks like it's going to cost $2.2 trillion over a decade. It could well have a secondary benefit for business, which is obviously what he's hoping. Mm-hmm. But therein lies the mixed reaction that you get to him, whether you buy in or not. And very few people sit on the fence, unfortunately, with Donald Trump.
So he's hoping that businesses would generate more revenue and thus
Absolutely.
Pay more taxes even at a lower rate.
Correct. So it boosts competitiveness, boosts the economy, boosts hiring, and ultimately feeds an upcycle. But unfortunately, what we don't tend to know up front is whether that's going to succeed. It's one of those hindsight questionnaires that needs to be filled in later.
So are you putting your money?
Yeah. So look, I suppose on the monetary conversation, I don't know whether there's any superstitious viewers. It's gone largely unnoticed, fortunately. But today is the 30-year anniversary of Black Friday, which was in fact the single largest drop on global exchanges. And we saw, I think it was the US, Europe, and Asia alone drop about 23% in a single day. So that was largely ignored today, fortunately. We saw a lot of positive sentiment, funny enough, coming out of global central bankers of all people who met at the IMF conference in Washington over the weekend. And I suppose there's a lot to cheer about in the global market at the moment. We see corporate earnings are particularly robust. We're looking at between the US and Europe somewhere between 11 and 14% growth for the current calendar year. The Europe economy is absolutely booming. It's growing at the fastest pace in 7 years at 2.2%. We've seen emerging markets benefit over the past 12 months. Emerging markets average is up 31%, and developed markets trailing with a respectable 16% gain. And I think what was the most interesting comment that I saw coming out of the meeting this weekend was the fact that of 192 countries in the world today, all but six of them are expected to post positive gains GDP-wise this current year.
Even South Africa?
South Africa is one
barely.
Of them. Fortunately, we are one of them, but barely. Yeah, so okay. Certainly not the strongest emerging market.
So the 30th anniversary of Black Friday, and yet markets don't seem worried about any of these events at all. So whether it's Donald Trump, whether it's Brexit, whether it's Austria's elections this weekend,
yeah.
Markets seem to be taking it in the stride. Do you think they're becoming too complacent?
Yeah, look, I think there's definitely a bit of a dislocation. If you were to watch news channels and see all the shocking headlines and all the risks on the horizon, you'd be surprised to switch channels and see almost uniformly across all stock markets recording new highs after new highs. And that certainly does create a little bit of anxiety, or at least it should create some anxiety with global investors, in that it appears that there could be a little bit of complacency creeping in.
Okay, you sent us a graph of the VIX index, so if we pull up that graph, we can maybe see what you're talking about.
Yes, absolutely.
Over there. I mean, what do you see as the big risks in the market at the moment?
So there's a number of big risks. I suppose the easiest risk to identify is the fact that we are so far into a global bull market. I think we're 115 months in at the moment. What you're looking at on the screen right now in terms of VIX is the volatility index, or Wall Street's fear gauge. The higher up the line goes, the more fear there is in the market, and you can see that sharp spike in 2008, global financial crisis, and again for the euro crisis. And I think what's most remarkable is where we find ourselves today. Over this 10-year period, it's almost at record lows. So what this does show is investors are particularly comfortable. And when we're this far into a bull market, when markets have run so hard, everything's at all-time highs, with the risks on the horizon, it almost seems a bit illogical that we're so comfortable. And I think it was captured best by Larry Summers, the former U.S. Treasury Secretary and respected academic, when he said the only thing we have to fear at the moment is a lack of fear in itself. So I think that captures it quite nicely. I'm not suggesting there is a correction just based on the length of the stock market. Earnings are certainly very favorable at the moment. Mm-hmm. But it's certainly not a cheap market, and unfortunately, when you go that far into a comfort zone, there is only one point, one way from here, and that is unfortunately a little bit of a sell-off.
Okay. Well, you mentioned U.S. earnings season. It's already underway. We've had quite a number of the banks already reporting, and it looks like most of them have been good. So I think Bank of America, quarterly profits up 15%. Trailing that was J.P. Morgan and Citibank. Wells Fargo, though, profit down by 19%.
Yeah, so I think what was odd about their release was, as you mentioned, all three experiencing an increase in revenue and profit and beating expectations, which is always great. Mm. But they did so on lower trading volumes, which was quite surprising.
And I saw fixed income trading was down quite sharply amongst
them all. Quite surprising. If you look at market volumes and you look at where the market is at, you would expect that to contribute a lot more to earnings. Nonetheless, we saw Wells Fargo, unfortunately, not experiencing the same sort of euphoria. We saw the results come out, I think it was on Friday, and they sold off about 2.5%. But the real discomfort there for Wells Fargo shareholders is the litigation costs, which appear to be chipping away at their revenue.
Yeah, so it's had a $1 billion legal settlement, Sam, but it also had a drop in mortgage banking revenue. Do you think any spillover from the problems it had last year when it was mis-selling products or selling products that hadn't asked customers if they wanted?
Yeah, look, that was quite suspicious when phantom accounts just get opened. So a lot of bad publicity from Wells Fargo. And unfortunately, you don't really understand where the rot is. Usually where there's smoke, there's fire, so I don't want to dismiss it. It could well be related. A lack of discipline in the past, it's obviously a focus at the moment, so I'd be surprised if it was continuing. But what happens is you enjoy those good years from your bad deeds for a while, and as soon as it starts to bite, slowly investors and shareholders need to start paying for it. So litigation costs, I suspect, are not going anywhere.
Your thoughts on the U.S. banks in a rising interest rate environment? Because I suppose higher interest rates have been helping them.
Yes, so higher interest rates, and if Donald Trump can pull it off, looser regulation should certainly play into their favor. So they've had very strong earnings. We've seen it for a number of consecutive reporting seasons now. But I wouldn't suggest it's limited to banks. We've seen generous earnings right across the board for U.S. counters. I think earnings today are in a position that they haven't been for 7 years in the case of the U.S. So it's quite consistent right across the U.S. earnings spectrum. Mm-hmm. And with each positive surprise, so the market drives higher. We've got earnings this week coming from Netflix. We've got General Electric, which is one to watch. Philip Morris is coming out, amongst many others. So particularly interesting, and I have a good feeling about earnings this time around.
Good. So you talked about rot perhaps at Wells Fargo. We've seen some rot at Kobe Steel, a Japanese steel maker. And I suppose this has implications for all of its customers as well.
Absolutely. So the headlines, unfortunately, were that Kobe Steel had been lying to no fewer than 500 clients about the quality of the steel that they've been producing.
It supplies motor cars or motor manufacturers.
Which is absolutely shocking. And another second blow to the reputation of Made in Japan came in the form of Nissan. So we saw Nissan also doing a million car recall. And there, although slightly different, there's a similar lack of discipline in that people that were doing the final quality checks on the Nissan vehicles before sending them out to customers mm-hmm. Lacked the necessary qualifications to sign it off, which is quite...
So the janitor?
Yeah, it would appear so.
Okay, and I see Kobe Steel was trading at 5-year lows this morning, so it's taking some punishment from that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you were a client of theirs today or a prospective client, you would be asking questions about whether to sign that deal.
Okay. Amazon entering the sports apparel market, developing its own sportswear line, and it's apparently using some of the manufacturers that make for Nike and Under Armour.
Yeah, so you've got to love when a company the size of Amazon tries to hide their next move, and it's the manufacturers that ultimately give them away. So the rumors in the market at the moment from manufacturers that they're talking to is for them to enter the direct sporting apparel market, whereby they'll be competing against the likes of a Nike, an Adidas, an Under Armour, and surprisingly Uniqlo. So those jackets that you see walking around shopping malls during winter. Yeah. What you saw was Nike sold off quite strongly initially and bounced back, fortunately. Under Armour less so. So I'd say the counters were down about 2.5%. Mm-hmm. And I suppose that's just the nature of a rumor. If that does materialize, nobody ever wants to compete with the likes of an Amazon, unfortunately.
Does Amazon want to be a manufacturer, though? Is it not moving outside of its comfort zone?
Yeah, so I think Amazon's one that is very difficult to define what their comfort zone is. It seems everywhere they go, they disrupt. I'm pretty sure a year ago you would have said food's out of their comfort zone. But there goes Whole Foods. So they have a knack for disrupting markets and the most unconventional markets. So I certainly wouldn't suggest that the rumor is just a rumor. It sounds like it's fairly reasonable.
Okay, so your stock pick today is Boeing, another customer of Kobe Steel. So let's hope that they haven't been fibbed to about the strength of the airplanes. But you like Boeing.
Yeah, so Boeing's one we've had in our portfolios for some time. It's one that is looking a little bit less attractive given how hard it has run of late. It is, of course, a commercial jet stream engineer, producer, and marketer across the globe. It is not particularly cheap at 25 PE. It's slightly cheaper than the market. That is despite a 101% rally over the past 12 months. Mm-hmm. They have some very nice technologies, so incubators generating new technology in aviation. Think along the lines of swapping out batteries on commercial airplanes, and they suggest that could be the case in as little as 5 years. They also have a very interesting military division. It's not a bad time to be in the military game when headlines suggest that people are ramping up military efforts and there's increasing global tension. So a particularly interesting counter and one that we hold in our portfolio.
And I suppose it would also benefit from Donald Trump slapping massive duties onto rivals like Bombardier.
Absolutely. So Donald Trump has a knack for disrupting markets with tariffs. We saw him doing so in the commodity space and now in the car space and of course, airlines.
Okay. Stephen, we have to leave it there just for a moment. We're going to a short break. When we come back, we take a look at Methodical Investments Global Equity Fund. That's with Chief Investment Officer Stephen van Jaarsveld. Don't go anywhere. Welcome Welcome back. You're watching Global Investors. Still with me in studio, Stephen Schultz from Momentum Investments. We're also joined by Methodical Investment Management's CIO, Stephen van Jaarsveld, to state the investment case for their global equity fund. So all three Stephens tonight. Stephen van Jaarsveld, Methodical Investment Management, who are you?
Thanks, Stephen. The Methodical Investment Management, we are a systematic investment manager. And what that means is we follow a rules-based approach when it comes to investing and finding opportunities in the market. In South Africa, usually people automatically jump to the smart beta world or the indexation world, where globally systematic investing is quite it's a big theme out there. It's systems and machines finding opportunities for you, and then you making the decisions on it, basically.
So you still do make allocation decisions around the portfolio.
So we design the environment where the system goes and look, and then it implements those strategies on a very systematic way. What we do in the office every day is we try and evolve the system to try and execute better and more efficiently.
Okay, so your global equity fund's pretty new.
Yes.
You launched it last August, but you only started taking retail investors as recently as about 3 or 4 months ago.
Yes, so the strategy launched in June when we started trading it, and then we launched the retail fund, which is a UCITS fund based in Dublin, in August 2016. And since June, we've done well. It's we ahead of the benchmark since June, and then it's one thing to also mention is it's only a developed market fund. So we only invest, if you look at the world map like this, and you draw a line through the US, Europe, little bit of the Asians and Australasia, that is our universe.
Why specifically those markets?
So, you know, being a systematic manager, you can actually go and test your theories. So we've actually included some of the emerging markets when we started out, to try and test how our strategies would actually work there. And we found that emerging markets actually add a lot of volatility, especially from a currency point of view. As South Africans, we're quite used to currency volatility, but everyone rides in the UK when the pound drops at 20%. So from a return risk perspective, we've actually decided not to include EMs in there. And you can get some EM exposure through your DM counters, like something like BMW has massive exposure to China, but it is a German-listed company.
Do you think that might put you at a disadvantage to your benchmark, which is the MSCI World, and would have some emerging markets, particularly when emerging markets do come back into favor and perhaps do well?
It is. So being systematic, we rely on data. So we always, it takes a while for the ship to change. We always wait for what they call published earnings. So when only after earnings is published, then the portfolio readjusts itself. And then usually when EMs do well, these counters within developed markets would tend to, that are exposed to emerging markets, would tend to come into the portfolio more.
Yeah. Stephen, your thoughts on systematic investing?
Yeah, look, so
investing?
Am I correct in assuming that it's largely a numbers-driven algorithm game?
Yes.
Is there any layer of due diligence you do on the stocks? Is there something that could stick out from a model that just doesn't make you comfortable managing the portfolio?
So when at Methodical, we've got an investment process where or a testing environment where we say, whenever we test a strategy, it has to work on everything in all markets over all sectors. We never do data fitting, so we never actually go into a sector and say, we prefer mining stocks to be traded this way and banking stocks to be traded this way. It has to work overall. So yes, sometimes we call them false signals. Sometimes we do have false signals that enter the portfolio, but because it's quite a large and diverse portfolio, the false signals tend to fall out. We know our hit rate in the global space is about 59% of all the stocks we buy make money. So we have designed a process to allocate more to the winners and less to losers. So the false signals, you want to allocate as little as possible to them. Okay.
So how aligned are you in your asset allocation to the MSCI World? Because I see you're also overweight US equities as the MSCI World would be.
So yes. So geographically, we try and keep it pretty much on par. We are a little bit overweight when it comes to Australia and Canada. Our models do really well there, and it's a tactical decision from our side. In the US, we're about 50 to 55% allocated, depending on how well it does relative to the others. And then Europe also, the whole Eurozone stock 600 is the second largest at about 35%.
Okay.
And I see on a risk rating basis, you've rated it a 5 out of 7.
Yes.
Despite the fact that it's a pure equity fund.
Yes.
What is the logic behind that? Are there risk management mechanisms within the portfolio?
Absolutely. So we've got two systems. We've got a system that we call Propel and a system that we call Navigate. Propel is our alpha model. It's the model that goes and finds opportunities in the market for us. Navigate is a system that manages the risk for us. And how Navigate works, it upweights and downweights counters within the portfolio according to how risky they are, and we measure risk on relative value. So, and when we talk about relative value, we talk about relative value to itself. Mm-hmm. So people get used to paying 180 multiple for something like Amazon or 120 multiple for a Naspers, but something like a Sasol at a multiple of 20 might be quite rich, where something like a Naspers at a multiple of 80 might be quite cheap.
Mm. Okay. I mean, some of the stocks that have cropped up in the top 10, and you don't have Amazon there or Facebook, so none of the FANGs in there. There's some interesting shares like Activision, Blizzard, and Micron. Your Boeing's in there.
Yeah. As is Netflix.
And Netflix. Okay, so we do have one of the FANGs. You wouldn't have chosen those. They are chosen by the machine.
Yes. Yeah, so a lot of times we run a local and a global fund, and a lot of times whenever the global fund list gets populated, we go and research some of these companies to find out. So Activision Blizzard is a great example where they're only the third company to get into the Fortune 500, a third gaming company, and they own games like World of Warcraft, Call of Duty. They also have a business called Major League Gaming, which is exactly what it is. It's like the NFL or the basketball league, mm-hmm. where guys actually game against each other, and guys, the top guys earn from $300,000 to $500,000 a year, so they actually make a good living out of it.
And speaking of crazy tech multiples,
yes.
I assume what feeds the model is data. Does that then? Am I correct in assuming that would then alienate some of the tech IPOs that gets the market so excited?
Absolutely.
Given that there's no data.
Absolutely. So we have strict rules around our universe. So we only trade the largest 1,500 stocks in the world. It's for liquidity purposes. And secondly, that share has to have a minimum of at least 3-year track record before it can enter the portfolio, because we need enough data on it to be actually to know where the model should actually put it.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, do you make tactical allocations to sectors? So you have 24% in technology, big exposures to consumer cyclical and non-cyclical. Would you make tactical allocations there?
So now the portfolio is built up from the bottom up, the allocation. So we screen the universe on a stock basis, and whatever stocks enter the portfolio makes up the sector allocation in the portfolio. The only thing we have, the only thing we control is the geographical allocation of the portfolio.
And in terms of when the model signals buys and sells, I'm assuming that happens quite frequently.
Yes.
How do you guard against churning the portfolio and ramping up fees ultimately?
No. So so we know exactly the liquidity profile of the fund and how large, how frequent you should trade according to the size of the fund. Mm. So we actually try and trade as little as possible, and then according to liquidity, we'll ramp up trading. Okay. That. So we're very cost sensitive.
But, does that mean you don't necessarily move when you do see those sell signals?
No. We tend to trade more in the more liquid days, mm-hmm. which tend to be the end of the month and beginning of the month. Most liquidity events happen at that point in time. You'll see middle of the month it actually falls off quite dramatically. So we try and buy and sell off counters in those liquidity events. We have the least market impact.
Yeah. You said the universe of stocks you look at is about 1,500. How many shares are actually in the portfolio?
So there's 65 counters in the portfolio, so it is quite concentrated from a global fund point of view. But we quite like it. We always say in the office. You know, all the animals that get eaten, their eyes are on the side of their head, and all the animals that hunt them, their eyes in front. So we like the aggressive stance on that.
And I mean, would you stick to about 65 stocks, or are you looking at growing that?
Whenever we add a geography, we'll decide how many counts is in that geography, and then it would increase the allocation to the portfolio a little bit. But we'll never allocate anywhere if it doesn't increase the risk return payoff of the portfolio.
And how much does all this cost the investor?
So our retail fees for direct or platform fees is 1.3%. With a 15% performance fee above MSCI World. Obviously, for larger mandates and direct investing, that fee goes down a lot.
Mm. And tell me, how many guys would be supporting the management of this fund? I assume there's not a team of analysts, but rather a team of quants guys.
A team of quants guys, yeah. So we currently three guys in the office. We're looking for one more hire. Or not in the office, in the investment team, we have about 9 people currently in the office. Mm-hmm. So it's all quantic guys that we want working there. And we actually prefer guys that don't have financial experience, because we've learned that they tend to ask the right questions. Mm-hmm. Where finance guys sometimes, you know, they assume, or not assume they know it, they assume they should know it.
Mm-hmm. And your single best idea expressed in the portfolio?
Well, currently, to be honest, one of our favorites is a company called A2 Milk. It's an Aussie business. The guy studied at Cambridge, and he found that there's two types of proteins in milk called A2 and A1. And A1 actually makes you uncomfortable. Some people are uncomfortable when they drink milk, excuse me. And so they've actually found some cows that actually only produce the A2 strand of milk, and they started a dairy from this. Today, that business is a $33 million market cap business with 44 employees selling milk into the US, UK, China, Aussie, New Zealand. And the share price was $1 a year ago. It's $7 today. It's an amazing business. So that's some of the stuff we find with our quant process.
Okay. Stephen, you definitely piqued Stephen's interest. I'm afraid we have Stephen there. Probably get you in a year's time so we can see how this has all worked out. But thanks so much for coming through today.
Thank you very much.
That's all we have time for the show this week. Thanks again to our guests, the Stephens, for their insights. Thanks to you for watching. Same time next week. Goodbye.